All right, how's everybody doing? Everyone's like, no, I am giving you nothing, Ben. You're going to have to earn our trust. All right, I'm working on it. So this is Get Good at DevOps, Feature Flag Deployments with ASP.NET, Web API, and JavaScript. I'm Benjamin Day. I'm based out of Brookline, Massachusetts, which is basically Boston. We're surrounded on four sides by Boston. It's cool. So I do a bunch of TFS stuff. I'm a Microsoft MVP for Visual Studio ALM, and I teach a lot of Scrum classes, do a lot of software architecture, all that fun stuff, yada, yada, yada. I'm a certified trainer through scrum.org, teach four different classes through there. One is missing. www.benday.com is my website. And if any of you have Pluralsight subscriptions, I encourage you to go play all my classes end to end. Because that's how daddy gets paid. I don't really care if you pay attention to them. I just want you to start them at the top and run them end to end. And don't share screens. If your entire team's going to watch, they're all going to go to their desks in separate accounts, start it, watch end to end. All right. So I've got a DevOps Skills for Developers course with TFS 2015 that is dropping hopefully at the end of this month. So look for that. Coming soon. All right. Software development is hard. Anyone else sort of found that to be the case? Or do you all sort of work at like the cushiest jobs of all time? Yeah, we're at Hello World Corp. We ship Hello World every single day. It's all right. Come in around 10, leave around 10, 15. So software development is hard. And I would say that software delivery is even harder. So one of the things that I think is kind of wrong with our industry is partially the name of our industry, the software development industry. And the problem here is that when you think about software development industry, what do you think about? You think about coders banging out code, right? Well, there's a lot more that goes into it. So how do you get a feature into production? So this starts to think about, okay, well, we've got deployment, ops things, QA that might happen. There's requirements, there's DBAs, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot more to delivering software than just writing the code, checking into TFS. So that, I think, should get us into the DevOps mindset of it's not the software development industry, it's a software delivery industry. So when you think about that, that starts to think about, okay, well, what are all the things we have to do to get this into production? And the more that we can automate, the faster we can make that go, the closer we are to DevOps Nirvana. Right? Which takes us into branching and merging. So just a quick review on branching and merging. So the idea here is that it lets you work on similar code that's related through version control at the same time, but you're doing it in isolation. Okay, so you know, go off, like this little version over here is in its own branch and you can do a bunch of changes on that. It doesn't affect this branch over here of the same code. You know, they're all separated. Which usually when I teach TFS classes, the next question is like, great, so I can create 250 zillion branches and just go crazy. Well, no, you can't. Because like all things in life, there's a downside. So a branch is an integration credit card. So for thinking about credit cards, like if you've got a $10,000 limit, let's just make it a $50,000 limit. It's easier that way. You can go into, let's say, BMW dealer and say, I want to buy a card. So, okay, so you come in, you choose something that's, you know, $49,000. You hand them your credit card, and you basically pick up your car and go away. You've so far paid no real dollars. But then what happens about 30 days later? 30 days later, bill shows up for $49,000, and now the interest starts ticking. That causes some problems. Now, that same kind of thing happens when you're doing branching and merging. So for every branch, there's a merge. The merge is your credit card bill showing up and coming due. So you can branch and go work in isolation, but the merge gets a little bit trickier because now we have to bring it together. The stuff you did in isolation, how do you bring it together so to turn it into some done working software that we can actually deliver? So merging is expensive and painful. How many of you have a complex merge structure? Yeah. It probably takes, you probably spend at least a day per sprint working on merge, right? And sometimes it doesn't go so well. Well, one of the things to keep in mind is that you definitely can't call a feature done unless it's been fully integrated with the other features that you're supposed to be doing. That makes sense? So if you've got a feature that you've written in a branch and you say that it's done, but you haven't merged it with the other features that other people have done in branches that they say are done, well, you can't call it done because you don't know how that merge is going to go. You're going to have to pay that merge tax at some point. So if you're getting into branching and merging, you definitely have to keep it on the simple side. Less is more. In fact, I'm going to go a little bit further and say, best practice, don't branch. Yeah. So you got the little asterisk right there, unless you absolutely have to. So if you absolutely have to, first off, make sure you know why you're doing it. Don't just create a branch because you want to create a branch. Yeah?
I assume you're talking about TFS branches here and not Git branches.
I am talking about branches in general. I'm happy to talk about, I'm sort of thinking of it as either Git or TFS branches. Hopefully this is not particularly controversial, but I think that in Git, because it's easier to branch, you're more likely to come into this problem where you're creating 250 zillion branches. But what were you going for? Which actually was my next slide. So we have a genius guy in the third row. He knew exactly where I was going with this. Good point. So I think that, yes, you're right. In Git, the branches are easier, and I think the merging is easier, but you're still developing code in isolation. So the more that you go in separate directions, you know, the more likely it is that you're going to have a monster merge at the end. So if you integrate more often, you're paying that merge penalty down gradually. It's kind of like paying your credit card bill off every month, as opposed to, oh, we're going to wait for 6 months and then we're going to pay it. And at that point, you're not only paying the original amount, but you're also paying the interest that has accumulated since you last paid your credit card bill. Anyone, does that sort of make sense to everyone? Any questions while I take a drink? Hang on a sec, I couldn't hear what you said. The common, yeah, so the idea in the Git world is that you branch for every feature. And the idea on that is you branch for every feature so that you can do pull requests at the end and code reviews, right? Doesn't necessarily mean that the integration of those merges is going to be any easier. If you can get away with not doing that, then try not doing that. But anyway, the smaller your integration is, the more often you do the merge, the smaller the chance is that you're going to have an awful merge. So let's think typical branching structure. So I'm going to draw this out, and this is going to be in TFS speak, TFVC speak, but it still works for Git. So that's kind of small. So in the beginning, you've got main, trunk, origin, whatever the root of your team project is, whatever you choose to call the root of your branching structure. A lot of teams then grow off and create a dev branch. And then from that, they'll create their feature branches. So feature X, Y, and Z. And then on the other side, we've got releases. So where you can start getting into doing, this is less of a Git kind of thing to do. This is more of a centralized version control thing to do. For every release that you do, you create a release snapshot. And that allows you to do a bunch of hot fixes later on if you need to. And then meanwhile, not having problems with the work that you're doing going forward. So main, beginning of everything, it's your ultimate integration point before you ship. Dev typically is going to be an integration point for a release where you're pulling those features together. And then a lot of teams, just like what you're describing, have a branch for every single feature. Then at the end, you've got the release snapshot stuff, and that's going to be version numbered, so version 1, 2, 3, whatever the release number is going to be. And that would be your source of hotfixes. Now, let's think about this branching structure and turn it into what a typical release flow is going to look like. So you've got your work that's happening in feature X, Y, and Z. So you're going to merge your features to dev. So dev becomes your mixing pot. Fix, do some basic verification on whatever has made it into dev. And then when that looks good, you're going to merge it to main. And then you'll create a new release branch right before you push it off to the production servers. Now, getting into that, this starts getting you into the mindset of whatever has made it to main gets released. Which, when we're thinking about DevOps and feature flags, this is thinking about something called a code-based release model or a version control-based release model. So whatever makes it into the code, whatever makes it into version control in that particular branch that's going out, makes it to that servers as well. There's no difference between that. So let's think about how this can go when it goes wrong. So you've got three features, and you're trying to get ready to push something out. So feature X, you merge that, and of course that's easy because you're the first one to merge to dev. So high five me. Commit the merge. Check in the merge. Next one, we do feature Y. That went in okay. It's a little bit harder than the first one because now there's, you know, a few conflicts that happened inside of between the feature X code and the feature Y code, but we, you know, generally did okay. Commit the merge. Now feature Z comes, and this is super crazy hard. Because it turns out that what you did in feature X really wasn't done. That team had missed some big path. You were expecting in feature Z that they'd figured this little bit out, and they hadn't. And now your feature Z merge is really awful. And in order to get that to work finally, you have to do some major surgery to remove the stuff that you've already merged. So that can be a real source of distraction. So, feature branch doesn't go very well, and that code, you have to do a lot of massaging to make it play nice with the other code that's already been committed. And in order to fix that major surgery, you're getting to something called cherry picking, where you're pulling little, you know, pulling change sets, pulling individual commits, making all kinds of modifications to move them around. That's really complicated, and that's really error prone. And if you're thinking about trying to ship done working software, that means you probably have a lot of delays. Delays are bad, right? We all want to make our sprint goal. We always want to ship out all the PBIs that our team forecasts we were going to do. And if we don't, well, sometimes people get cranky. Does anyone work for organizations where they get cranky if you don't get all your work done? Maybe, a little bit, just tiny, perhaps. So you want to watch out for this problem. So there's another flow of bad news and branching that can happen. So this would be change of plans. So you merge your features to dev, commit the merge. So X, Y, and Z all merge, that's just fine. Then your boss decides that they only want feature X and Z to go live. We're going to hold back feature Y. Now what? Well, it's already been merged. We already mixed it all up. So how do we get that stuff? Well, we're going to have to do some kind of special merge, cherry picking of those features. There's a code for feature X and Z to main, and that becomes our place that we get that done. Now, if we do that cherry pick, and then that's for this sprint, and then we have the next sprint that comes up, and now we actually want feature Y to go live, how much fun is it going to be to get that merged? Not very fun. Because you already kind of like the version control system is thinking, oh, well, you just didn't want this, so I forgot about it, and good luck. So, yeah. So my point here is that doing releases based on just source control can be a real time suck, and they can cause some real problems. So that release based on source control, whatever is in the branch that you're releasing from, that goes to production. So that also has the flip side mindset of whatever's in production is also live and available. So pros on this, super easy to understand. So if it's there, it goes there, the end. Thank you very much. The downside is that you've got a lot of coordination that can happen, and that can be, well, a problem. Especially if people change their minds, especially if there's some sort of a a merge headache that happens at the last second that you're not ready for. This brings me to what we're here to talk about, feature flags. Feature flags are kind of awesome. The end. Thank you very much. Good night. I guess it's not night, is it? It's like 10 o'clock in the morning. All right, so feature flags are also known as feature toggles. Note to self, do not lean against this wall. This is not a real wall. So feature flags, feature toggles, this gets you into something called configuration-based releases. So for every feature that you're going to do, you wrap that code inside of basically an if block saying, is this flag, is this toggle, is this value set to true? If it's true, then the feature is turned on. If the value is not true, or if it's turned off, then that means that that feature is not live. So you're wrapping the feature code inside of checks to decide if that flag is on or not on. So this changes your mindset a little bit about how you do deploys. So you don't worry so much about whether or not a feature is done. You just worry about, well, if I deploy this thing, does it blow up the universe? If it doesn't melt a hole in the universe, then you can push it out to production. That then means that you get it into production and you just turn on whatever is ready. This has a nice side effect. Because you don't have to worry about doing all this feature branching and stuff and these merges to do a source code based deployment, and instead it's all based on configuration for these feature toggles, you can really get away with a lot less branching and merging. Another side effect is that it's a lot easier to schedule deployments. So if you have to drop a feature on a certain day, well, then that means that if you have to be there at 9 a.m. Eastern time to make that happen, then you need to make sure that you get that code onto those servers at about 8:59 in the morning Eastern time, and that's kind of a pain. You have to be there. You have to do that stuff. As opposed to with a feature flag development, if you ship a bunch of features with the toggles or the flags turned to off, you can pretty much push that code whenever you want. And now if you're supposed to go live with a bunch of features, what do you have to do? Flip a couple bits, and now the flags light up, the features light up. So you turn them on when you're ready, as opposed to trying to schedule what bits hit that server. Any questions so far? Anyone paying attention? Bueller, you're raising your hand because yes, I'm paying attention, or no? Yeah. So what do you do with major refactorings? Find another job? I don't know. What do you have in mind for a major refactoring?
Say you've got some legacy code.
So you've got some stuff that doesn't have unit tests on it, and you need to refactor that to get unit tests, and then the QA team wants to test that first. I don't know that feature flags necessarily helps you out with that. Actually, one of the demos that I do in this a little bit further ahead is that I use dependency injection and Unity or IOC frameworks to just have different versions of the same code side by side, and I'll conditionally load one version versus the other. But you're right, that's really hard. Like, major refactorings is really hard. Especially, like, let's say that you've got something that's running in MySQL and you figured out that MySQL is just not meeting your scaling needs or your disaster recovery needs, and you want to refactor it to do, Azure Storage or SQL Azure or something like that. What you're going to need to do is you're probably going to run them side by side. You're going to have to modify your code so that it knows how to talk to both versions simultaneously, and then flip one on and one off, or both of them on, both of them off. And it gets really complicated. Basically, what I'm trying to say is, in that case, you would have to really build your system so that it's ready to take that stuff. Repository pattern, unit of work pattern, IOC, all these great design patterns really help you out for these complex situations. Any other questions? Yeah. Database change? Like a basic database change? Or are we talking like... Yeah. Next question. that's just really tough. I'm not saying that feature flags are going to make your life super easy, but it gives you some options. So in that case, one, I would really hope for you that you coded to the repository pattern. If you haven't looked it up, repository pattern basically is an interface abstraction, around your data access logic. And if you're using interfaces and you're using repository pattern and then you're using dependency injection, that gives you a lot of room to decide what you're going to do. And honestly, if you've got table changes that are happening, I might consider running two versions of the same table in production at the same time and having some way to keep them up to date. It's hard though. That's a tricky, tricky situation. There's another question. Yep.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, what difference does it make? So for instance,
yep.
Us, what we do is that with the source code release flow, what we do is every feature is actually configurable. So we can turn it on and off.
Yep.
So once it goes in, if we don't like it, your boss doesn't like it, you can, that configuration off. So what difference or what benefit does it?
Actually, my very next slide. What are the benefits of feature flags? Well, new levels of flexibility, for sure. It lets you deploy multiple versions of the same code side by side. So kind of like what you do in branching, where you kind of have two different versions in flight simultaneously, now you kind of have two in the same branch, and you're using configuration to say, are we running this version or this version? Theoretically, like new versions of UIs at the same time. That happens. There are two versions of UIs at the same time, and you flip over from the new version to the old version based on configuration. Another one would be private betas. Like, this is really nice. Rather than having to have a private beta server, you could have it on one server, and then based on that person's login, you can turn features on and off for that login or for a smaller section of people. That lets you do A/B testing. So you could start saying, okay, well, this crowd over here, anyone with a Microsoft.com email address gets this version of the code. Anyone with a live.com email address gets this version. Anyone that logs in with an @Gmail account gets this version. And then you can start doing some testing to see who likes what stuff. So A/B testing. So do more people engage with this one or with this one? Which I guess I'm on camera, but I'm going to tell a weird story. I met my wife through OkCupid, and I really wished that OkCupid had A/B testing for my online dating profile, because that way it's like, well, do people like me more with this picture, or if I say this or this? Anyway, I still got married. It worked out. Moving on. Another thing that's great with feature flags is rollback. So if something turns out to not be working very well, or it turns out that, wow, people hate it, you can just go into that flag and turn it off. And now the feature disappears. As opposed to, or it goes back to the original version of the feature. That's another thing. As opposed to, okay, well, they don't like it, so now we have to create a new build and push that build onto the server. That takes time, especially if you have to make code go through branches. So that's annoying. So overall, I would say that this is great for Scrum and DevOps. Great for Scrum because you focus less on branching and merging, more about shipping done working software. Great for DevOps because now, well, you don't have the branches you have to worry about, and you can get more towards a continuous deployment model. Yeah.
The operation feature flag, but the work only if your features are fully decoupled. Once it happens, we are going back to the mansion, and also recently it has been kind of popular to do dust.com branch, which mitigates some of the problems you brought up. Is it actually going to work what you're trying to convey here?
Is it going to work what I'm trying to convey here? Probably not. I'm completely full of whatever. No, yes, it's going to work. I'm not saying that any of this stuff is super easy. And what you're talking about, where you said, like, what if user interface has a user interface feature one has a dependency on feature two, and then there's a feature flag situation between the two of them. How do you handle that? Yeah, that's hard. So in ASP.NET MVC, maybe the answer is you've got two different views. So depending on the flag, you serve this view or you serve this view. Or maybe you just have to, maybe that particular feature is not doable with feature flags. This is more giving you another tool in your tool belt. Yeah.
You're talking about flipping these on and off and putting if blocks in your code for
yep.
if I've got this feature, do this. Does your process ever involve going back and saying, yeah, we've got this feature, we're never going to remove it?
Yep.
Now you're going back into code, wiping out all that old stuff that
Absolutely. It's like you read my mind. So the drawbacks. One, definitely adds complexity to the code. So you're going to have to get some stuff. You're going to be wrapping those blocks, which then can get really confusing to read. The third thing is that basically feature flags are technical debt. So in Scrum, if anyone was in my session just a half an hour ago, I talked about the definition of done. Definition of done says here are all the things we have to do in order to call a feature fully 100% done. And the idea in that is that there's no tech debt in that. Now, with these feature flags, what you're doing is you're saying, okay, we're going to deliver a new feature, but it's not going to be 100% done, because at some point when this feature has been officially signed off on and this is great and this is what we're going to use forever, we have to come back and pull those feature flags out. So if you're in the Scrum world, that means that you have work on a feature that basically leaks over sprint boundaries, which is kind of not awesome. So you have to be aware of the fact that that happens. So this is, you know, you're going to be doing a balancing act between, okay, well, should we use feature flags and get this flexibility, or should we not use feature flags and not have to worry about cleaning up afterwards? Because if you've got two features that are, just a second, if you've got two features side by side that are deployed, you know, version one and version two, well, when you know for a fact that version two is nice and solid and good, you're going to have to go back and schedule the time to pull out the version one stuff. Yeah, question? Hang on 1 second, I'm not really hearing you. Other than config settings that show up in webconfig?
Yeah, like what are other ways to turn?
Well, actually, I'm going to do some code demos in a few minutes. So the question was basically they're doing something similar to feature flags, but the flags are in web.config. That's a perfectly valid place to put it. It doesn't give you all the flexibility that you might want. I'm going to show you how to do it with a database in a few minutes. But anyway, so back to that technical debt that's in there. Using feature flags can a lot of times get, well, it can rot your brain as a team. So if you're focused on definition of done, and you've got 20 steps, this is what done means, and that gets you focused on, well, it has to be 100% done, and it means it also has to work. If you've got feature flags in there, a lot of times teams use that as an excuse. Be like, whatever. If it's not any good, we'll just turn it off. So the risk, you're lowering your risk of rolling stuff back. So that also does, that sort of loses the focus in your mind on, we got to make sure that this really works the first time. So there's kind of a moral hazard sometimes with doing feature flags. But in the grand scheme of things, it gives you a lot of flexibility that's really handy. Now, bringing this into, yeah.
Now, this seems like it would be a lot more difficult if you were selling software for others to install on their servers rather than Mm-hmm. Because then you don't know whether anyone's still using the old version.
So you're using packaged software and you don't know what features you can actually remove? Yeah, that's kind of tough. But that's also, so just as a chance to plug some stuff, App Insights would be really awesome for that. So putting feature usage into your application that runs on someone else's server, and then they're giving you telemetry on feature usage, that might be a way to solve that problem. So, yeah. You're welcome, Microsoft. Plugging your stuff. Okay, let's talk about DevOps. So the idea here is that you're trying to get as much stuff automated as you possibly can. So that whole delivery flow, how good are you at getting that out and then monitoring what you've got? So a way of sort of figuring out how good you are at DevOps. I stole these questions from David Starr. He's another MVP. So the big question would be, okay, how long does it take and what are the steps that has to happen to take a developer change set from developer workstation and get it into production? What are those steps? How long does it take? That exercise of trying to figure that out starts to sketch out what your DevOps flow is going to be. So if you want to start going fast, you need to start automating. So that automation runs faster than a human could do it. It's going to run it the same time, same way every time. And that's going to give you a lot of reliability and repeatability. It also means that if you've coded up how you're going to get your stuff deployed, that you code it up one time and now you can focus on other stuff. So that changes your focus, gives you more time to work on the actual software development stuff. Now, the purpose of DevOps is to increase the speed of feedback. That might sound a little bit weird. It feels like DevOps is about trying to get stuff into production as fast as we possibly can. But that's not really the main reason why we're doing it. We're doing it so that we can put it out in production and then find out if people like it. Are they using it? Are we getting more revenue out of this? Are there things they want to change? Now, that just changes the mindset a bit. So you're trying to speed up that process so you can get it out there as fast as you can, get the feedback as fast as you can. Side effect of DevOps is that it also increases the speed at which you make mistakes. So you're going to try to get it out there faster, and sometimes you're going to create errors, things are going to fall over. But because you've got so much automation, the mistakes are less of a problem. Because you detect that you've got a problem, and now you just fix it quickly, blast out a new build with automation or whatever, turn off a feature flag, and now you're moving forward. So if you're in a Scrum world, your product owner cares a ton about what that feedback is, because everything that you're doing as a product owner is basically an experiment. So throw out a new feature. Do people like this? We're experimenting with this to find out if people like it. So what you want to do is you want to build as little code as possible, known as a minimum viable product, MVP. And you're going to ship that and gather feedback, and that becomes what your experiment is going to be. Now, if I'm in product owner mode, I don't necessarily always want to commit my entire life and my entire being to these experiments. So you've probably heard it like this: go big or go home. Well, personally, I like to go small and quietly, and if people don't like my stuff, I'm just going to quietly remove it. This becomes really helpful in that Scrum world. And this is where feature flags become really helpful. Because feature flags let you go quietly, and if it doesn't work, you just roll it back by flipping a flag. So you don't have to make as many big, high-profile experiments anymore. You can do a lot of little experiments that don't necessarily change how your entire business works. So strategically, feature flags can really help out that Scrum process. It help out that agile thinking, that experimentation thinking, because it lets you go small and go quietly and go home if it's not working. It minimizes your embarrassing failures. All right, so into some of the technical stuff. So implementation tips. If you're going to roll your own, it's actually not that hard. So there's a, you might have seen from Microsoft, there's this thing called LaunchDarkly. It's a company that they've been working with. They have a feature flag implementation in the cloud. Looks good. If you want to really get your head around this, so I'm not gonna be showing you how to do LaunchDarkly today, but it's there. What I'm gonna work you through here in the code in this session is basically the mindset of building your own and getting feature flag implementations working in your code. So first tip, use interfaces, use dependency injection. So create an iFeature Manager interface. And each feature flag that you have should be a Boolean property. So I'm assuming we're writing in C# here. So public bool, my flag, and then have a getter, right? Do not use strings. So saying, having something where you say is feature enabled and you pass it the name of the feature in a string, that becomes really hard. Anyone want to guess why? No, it's because when you want to remove that flag later on, you can't rely on the compiler to tell you where that thing is. So if you use a Boolean property hanging off of iFeatureManager saying whether or not, you know, search v2 is enabled, if you want to remove that flag, first thing you do, go to iFeatureManager, remove that property, hit build, it shows you all the places in your code base where you need to remove that flag. So that basically sets you up to make sure that you can remove it more easily. If you use magic strings, the compiler is probably not going to detect that. So any place that you're going to use that iFeedback Manager, because that should be Feature Manager. Let me change that right this second. That's called being agile. So whenever you need to reference that feature manager, you need to make a decision about whether or not a feature flag is turned on or not, inject that interface. So that helps, that yet again makes it easy for you to detect where you have to remove stuff later on. Okay, any questions before I get into the demos? Cool. All right, so I'm going to show you some basic feature flag implementations, show you how to do two features side by side, do some undeploy, do some private beta, and away we go. All right, let me load up my application. All right, so my big application here is a database that is using all of the presidents of the United States. So date of birth, date of death. If we click into them, let's look at the details. We've got where were they born, where did they die, what state it was, a whole bunch of information in here. And at the moment, we've just got a nice list right here. Actually, so this is like a little history quiz. Which president caused me to blow up my object model? And why? Cleveland, why? Two non-consecutive terms. Ugh, Grover, making my life difficult. So my data model ends up being a lot more complex because of that. All right, so diving into this, let's say that one of the features that we want to work on is a search feature. So we want to search by first name and last name, and we want to put that in, but we're not entirely sure that, you know, we don't want to do the whole fancy branching and merging stuff, so let's go in and start working on that feature. Nope, I didn't install that. Cool. And Visual Studio has hung. Okay. So first thing that I've done, can you read that? Is that big enough?
No.
No? Well, that was honest feedback. How about now? All right. I'm assuming that I'm taking your silence as agreement. That's not how it works in Robert's Rules of Order. Okay, so first thing that I did is I declared a feature manager. So I know I've got a bunch of features that I'm gonna do. I'm gonna do search, and then I've got another search that we're working on, which is by birth and death state. I've got some performance counter stuff I'm gonna throw in there at some point, some feature usage logging, and some customer satisfaction. So for each of those features, I've declared a getter property on this interface, okay? So let's come in here and look at my navigation. Oh, come on. So this is an ASP.NET MVC application. So underscore layout is going to have the stuff that draws our menu bar, right? So on my search feature, I've got some code right here. So I've declared another utility class called feature utility that knows how to get that reference of iFeatureManager. And it says, okay, if the search feature is set to true, then give us the search link. If not, it doesn't show up. So that's one of the first things we can do. So for a feature, whether or not you can get to it in the nav is a pretty big way of turning things on and turning things off. So let's hop into our feature. All right, so for my feature management, so I've declared a class, an entity class that's used by Entity Framework called feature, and it's got a bunch of fields on it. It's got name, and the name is gonna be the name of the feature. Is enabled, it's gonna be a true or false, saying is it turned on or not, and then just ignore that last one for right this second. So that lets me basically store that in a database. So down here in SQL Server Management Studio, it ultimately comes down to a table. So I can put all these flags in here and then turn them on and turn them off individually. Now, thinking about the question about putting these flags inside a web config, I like putting them into the database as opposed to in web config, because if you modify web config, bounces the app pool, it can be a little bit disturbing. A little bit disruptive. And then also, if you've got a pool of servers that are out there, then you'd have to go to each server and edit that web config. If you put it in that shared common space, the database, well, the app talks to that, decides what the flag values are, and then works it that way. That allows you to keep your configuration data separate from your deployment, which just makes it a little easier. All right, so let's go to the actual feature manager implementation. Okay, so this is the class that actually implements iFeatureManager. So remember, iFeatureManager has all those public bool properties on it for each individual feature, saying whether or not it's on or not. So when this class gets newed up, first thing that happens is it goes and initializes the stuff using a class called feature repository. So iFeature repository is a wrapper that I created around Entity Framework, just so that I can, well, basically make it unit testable. So another side effect, this has nothing to do with feature flags, is if you code to interfaces, it makes your unit testing so much easier, because you can start using mocks and stubs and all that kind of stuff to really test what you want to do without having to deal with the database. All right, so let's come in here, we look at that. So feature repository comes out, it grabs all the features, and then it loads it into the object. And then ultimately, let's look at search. So here's the implementation of that search flag. Comes in here, says is enabled, goes through, runs some stuff, and if it's turned on, it says true. If it's not, it returns false. So this is the part of the code that really figures out whether or not something is on or not. Now, let's bring this down and start looking at the implementation in our controller. So for that search feature, I've got search controller. And on my constructor, one of the things I'm passing in is iFeature Manager, because it's going to need to make some decisions about whether or not features are turned on or versions of features are turned on. So one of the big things right here is this. So if somebody tries to access the search feature and it's not on, if they've guessed the route to this controller, if it's not turned on, I want to give them an HTTP not found. Basically, I don't want someone to just run something that I just haven't put in the UI. I want to kick them out entirely. So that's one reason to pass in that feature manager. Pass that in, and then if it's turned on, we run that search. So I've got two different versions of search deployed side by side. We'll come to that in a second. So if search is turned on, it's going to serve up search. So let's turn it on right now. And I'm going to open up a different tab. Okay. So I have an admin screen that I created that's part of my project. So for search, I'm going to go in here to the search flag, set it to enabled, click save, and as soon as I reload, search shows up in the menu. Now we click on search, and let's do search on first name Ben. Finds us Benjamin Harrison, and there you go. So that's an implementation of feature flags. So let's say that that turns out that that's not working very well. Oops, come back. And we need to go and get rid of this. If we need to undeploy it, come back into that flag, uncheck it, hit save, and it's disappeared. This would be really helpful. Being able to make a feature go away is really great. Like this has probably happened to you before. You push a feature out there, and you think it's fine. Works well on your desktop machine, works well in test. But when you actually put it in production and you have 20,000 people hitting your site, it basically is like causing the lights to dim because it's so unperformant. That's one of those cases where you want to like, oh, maybe we need to go back to the drawing board on this. So rather than having that one feature bring down your entire application and bring down your data center, hop into your flag definition, set it to off, flag goes away, performance problem goes away. Basically, you live to fight another day. Okay? Any questions on that? Yeah. Hang on one second, I can't really hear you. I'll come up to you. Now, I'm gradually going deaf. So I went to school for music, so 20 plus years in music means that my hearing's not so good anymore. Yes?
So you have those features, right? Search and such, web, update, state, and all that.
Yep.
Will they ever go away since we are dependent on each feature in our code? So does it remain in your tables?
So do these values remain in the tables? Do these feature flags remain in our tables? For right now, yeah, they're remaining. But when we decide that search is really good and we're going to keep it, then at some point we'll schedule the work to remove that flag entirely. So then that just disappears.
So removing the flag means you are not going to require the feature manager in the constructor.
Quite possibly. So that, yes, if you find, like for the search controller right now requires us to pass in an instance of iFeature Manager. If search controller at some point doesn't need to do any decisions related to feature flags, then yeah, it's perfectly fine to just rip that dependency out of the constructor. And if you're using a dependency injection framework, then it just automatically works. So that's one way of dealing with the technical debt on that. Any other questions? All right, I'm going to take another drink of water. Okay, so let's turn search back on. And now let's say that we're working on a new version of search. So right now we've got first name search and last name search. That's great, but let's say that we want to start doing some other stuff like birth state, death state, which if you're doing a history database, that's kind of a handy feature. So what we can do, we come in here and on our feature manager, we declare another feature. So search by birth and death state. And now let's come back to our search controller. Now, depending on whether or not that is turned on, we're going to serve up a different version of the user interface. So if the search by birth death state is turned on to true, then what we'll do is we're going to return a different view entirely from what we did. So let's go to our view definition for search. So under this, we actually have two. So we've got the regular default, so index.cshtml. This is what we're going to use when we're just displaying the regular original first name, last name search. And guess what it's got on there? It only has fields for first name and last name. Versus if we need to do that next version of the feature, we add a different version in there that has first name, last name, birth state, death state in there. So now we're using some of the goodness that comes to us through MVC to serve up slightly different views, but we're still using the same controller. Now coming into here, we do that just by saying, okay, well, here's the model we're going to use. Here's the view we want you to return, and do that. So let's go and run that code again. Let's turn on the new version of that search. So first off, in this one, prove to you first name and last name is there. We'll turn on the new version of search, reload our page, and now we're on a new page. So let's do search by death state, New Jersey. So here's all the ones that died in New Jersey. I thought there was more than that, actually. When I was doing this demo, I was like, wow, there's like one state, and I thought it was New Jersey, that all the presidents died in. It's just like they got done with being president, and they're like, yeah, I'm going to go to New Jersey and die. So congratulations. You think it is? Let's try that. Yeah, there you go, Virginia. No, Ohio's actually pretty low. Well, anyway, as we have this, we now have a different back end that's happening. So let's go back to our controller. Let's go to the method that actually does our search. So if it's the new version of the search, it's going to call a different version of the search logic than on the other one. So we're going to have to code in various places to route our calls into the appropriate place. Does that make sense? So there's some extra coding that goes into here, but then let's say that at some point we want to pull it out. Let's come in here and let's just say comment out the new version of search. Let's say that's going to live there forever. Hit build. Shows us all the places in our code that we have to go make that change. So using that type safe property for each of your features makes it a lot easier for you to discover where you have to remove it when you decide ultimately you want to remove that feature flag. Make sense? Let's come back to here. All right. All right, so there are some other things that can be a little bit more complex to do. So someone had asked a question about, what if you've got like a really big change that has to happen? So one of the things that I was thinking about as a feature would be feature logging. So this is also known as telemetry. How many people are using your feature? Now, if you're a product owner in Scrum or an Agile person, it's really helpful in that experiment mindset to know, okay, well, was my experiment even used? Like, if you spent a ton of effort building something and then only one person clicks on it, was that a good investment? Probably not. So this is another thing with these small experiments. Make a small experiment, get it out there, measure through telemetry whether or not anyone actually used that stuff. Now, retrofitting telemetry into your application can get that's a big change. So on my president service object, so president service in this case is a class that knows how to handle all my search and load, my details, my editing, so that's basically where all the logic for this application goes through. That became the place that I could put in my telemetry. So for the basic stuff, it's just basic code. But when I need to go do it with logging, with feature logging, now my dependencies change. So now I have a dependency on the logging framework for logging my feature usage. And then in all of my calls, I have to go and do calls to write usage logging in there. That changes quite a bit how this actually works. Now, I've got a class called Object Factory. Object Factory is my wrapper around my dependency injection framework. So I'm using Unity right now for dependency injection. And you can use feature flags even when you're newing up your Unity framework. So if you come in here, if I've turned on feature usage logging, then I'm going to say, okay, well, register this version of this class to be part of the interface. And if it's not, then just serve the regular one. So dependency injection is really your friend. Inversion of control, IOC frameworks are your friend when you get into doing feature flag code. Because now you can say, all right, we'll replace this whole section wholesale. So rather than doing a whole bunch of little if-then blocks all over the place to change how things work, sometimes it makes more sense from a coding standpoint to just say, all right, copy, paste, rename, and have two versions of a class side by side inside of your namespace. So in this case, I've got president service, and I have president service with logging, and I'm using IOC to decide which one goes. That make sense? All right. Now, what's the downside of this, doing it here, if you're in ASP.NET? This is one of these cases, since the IOC framework only gets loaded on the first time, you wouldn't be able to do that nice toggle of a feature. If you needed to make a change that was like this, you'd have to bounce the app domain to make it reload this configuration. Which is not as bad, but it can, once again, that can be a little disruptive. So let's turn that feature on. I'm going to turn it on in the database. Let's rerun the app. And now this logging table should be getting populated. So we've got one thing in here saying someone used president get all. Let's do some more navigation through the application. Let's load up details on John Adams. Rerun this. So as we've done this, now we've turned on telemetry information. So we're starting to gather feature usage. If we wanted to get really crazy about managing customer satisfaction, we could just have customer satisfaction section turn that on. And now we can have our little super ugly feedback where we can just click on stuff saying, I'm happy, not happy, whatever. That stuff gets in there. And if somebody says, I really hate those yellow frowny faces or whatever, just go ahead and turn it back off and it's hidden. Okay? Any questions before I dive into public betas? All right. So let's come back over to our configuration for our flags. Where did that go? Here we go. So sometimes you're going to want to run demos just for small groups of people or maybe individuals. So in this case, let's turn on, let's turn search by birth death state off for everybody. So now the default is that people are just going to get first name and last name search. Okay? And now let's add another feature flag for search by birth and death state. We turn it on, and let's say that it is for a username called test@test.org. Click create. And right now, we're just logged in as, we're not even logged in. So we've got that old version of that feature showing up. Let's log in. So now if we go to search, just that one user is getting that feature. So this is a really great way to pilot some stuff. So now also, maybe the thing that you do is that for only that certain user, you get the feedback flags. So let's get rid of, let's change customer satisfaction flag to only be on for test@test.org. So now only I'm getting that, so that maybe I'm saying, okay, go try this out. Try out these new features. Tell us what you think. Happy. And now we're capturing that stuff. But if I log off, go to anonymous user, my customer satisfaction info goes away and I'm defaulting back to the regular version of this. So this lets us have two versions of the application, two versions of a feature running side by side, deployed at the same time, no branching required. All right? Any questions on that? All right. Pretty much running out of time, so let's wrap up with slides because everyone loves slides. Okay, so things to remember. A feature flag, if you add it into your code, it's almost definitely technical debt because you're putting that in as an experiment. When you've confirmed the experiment and you've confirmed that you want to keep that version of the feature in the product, well, then you should go in, remove the feature flag code so you don't have that overhead anymore. You're not carrying that around. What you can get into if you don't go through and remove those feature flags, I've heard of some companies that have this, that they basically have 30,000 flags that they've never cleaned up, and their code base becomes an absolute nightmarish mess. Because they're looking at it, and it's all these weird branches in the code, if branches, looking at, is this feature turned on or not? And trying to get stuff out, now the feature flag implementation gets in your way. So the way of thinking about this is your feature flag implementation, that system, that architecture for feature flags, that's forever, but the individual flags are very, very temporary. So watch out for technical debt and enjoy your feature flags. Any last questions? I'm going to give you a couple minutes back. Yeah. Should I walk up to you? That was a good sound. I'm getting old. Yes, what's your question?
That feature flags, but I see the, going through the database and writing there and coming back to the global.asx or like app.start and putting there and using the dependency injections again. If there are like, you know, 12 or 13, 15 servers, we have to go and restart each server, right?
Oh, for that case, yeah. Where you're doing it at initialization?
Yeah.
So
if that is the case, then why don't we go for web.config conf? Here also you need to restart the app.
That gets in, well, so I added that into the demo to show you that complexity moment. And that's definitely a discussion you should have with your team. So the one that I was saying where we change the implementation massively at initialization, so one way is showing you the feature utilization stuff, the other one isn't. If you've got a bunch of those and you have 20 servers, then that could be really disruptive to bounce 20 servers. Maybe you'd have to have some way of like notifying those servers, hey, reload your IOC framework. It's not necessarily easy, but it's easier to get that deployed side by side than it would be to say, okay, well, we don't have a new version of that feature, so now we're going to have to push to 20 different servers. Here's a bunch of new bits. That's what I'm getting at there. Any other questions? Shout it out. You're going to let me get all the way to the front, and then someone in the back row is going to ask me a question, aren't you? Oh. You did it. You literally did it. Good job. What was the question?
What's the difference between this and using role-based?
So what's the difference between this and doing role-based, basically security-based turning features on and off? Nothing. There's almost no difference. So actually, this is one of the things that customers sometimes get freaked out about. They're like, oh, we can't deploy partially implemented features or whatever. It's like, well, do you have certain users that get certain features and they're allowed to do some things but not other things? You're like, yeah. It's like, well, guess what? You're kind of doing feature flags already. So there you go.
What do you think the balance is, or what's the recommendation for a feature flag manager for a project or for a whole solution?
So should this be at the project level or be more at the enterprise level? I haven't really thought about that. What's in your mind about that? What could you see the pros and cons being?
That the manager, if it's a large solution, the manager can get big.
Yeah.
Split it out, but if you're keeping up with the maintenance of it,
I think you'd have to play with it and see what works for your team. You're right. If you've got an enterprise-wide feature flag configuration, you'd. What I showed you for that code is really simple. You probably would want to start grouping your flags by some kind of product name or something like that. But even then, that's going to start to get, there's going to be a lot of stuff. And does somebody accidentally knock a flag and decommission part of your application that wasn't intending to happen? Yeah, you're going to start having to get into some governance stuff, figuring out what's actually live, and you probably want to add some logging and definitely permissions against your feature flag system. Right now, this is wide open. So, any other questions?
Excuse me, is your demo that you gave, is the code available?
Yes, you can go to my blog right now. So, www.bende.com/blog. And this is the same code that I did in Austin a few weeks ago. So you can download that right this very second. I will tweet this out. Tweet out my links to my sample code and to my my slides. The conference already has my slides, so you should probably have access to that as we go. And yeah. What's that? It's the wrong slides?
One from your session this morning.
Oh, cool. Well, we'll get that fixed, won't we? All right. Yeah, so check out my blog. You can download the real slides. Yeah, question here. Yep.
Number of branches.
Yep.
I presume you're referring to not releases, correct? Because if you're working on a feature that perhaps has a bug in production, mm-hmm. You now need to fix that defect and then push it out immediately, you wouldn't want to work on that on your main branch.
So that's, yeah, I think I make a big distinction between branching for release like branching for hotfix. So if you branch for release, you're basically setting yourself up to be able to do hotfixes in the future without interrupting your development flow. I think that branch for release is pretty much penalty free. There really is not much of a downside for that. If you're in Git, you're going to do it based on tags, and you create a branch later on. But basically, the idea is you would say this is what's going to production. Where it becomes more of an issue is just those nasty merges that happen on the development side. Like, that stuff can really block you from efficiently getting stuff deployed to production. The branch for release doesn't do that. Branch for release insulates you and is an insurance policy about being able to fix problems quickly and easily as they show up in production. All right, I am officially out of time. So thank you very much for coming. Check out my blog, follow me on Twitter, and I will get you the info from this session really soon. Thank you very much for coming.